Night falls on Amsterdam. The lights of the city are ablaze, luring people into the streets, into places full of party. You stay home with the promise of a quiet evening in, an early bed, or you can't sleep. Wooden floors creak, clocks tick away the hours, the house seems to hum. You lie awake, thinking about mortality, about your children, how they grow up, life from one end to the other. You fall asleep in the early hours, and then you're woken by a gunshot. Shadows have fallen upon Dutch values and principles. Dial Nits, a podcast about the Dutch band Nits. A celebration of five decades of sophisticated music from the Netherlands. Your host, Erik Fekkon. The second album after Robert Jan's return to the Nits, and a very different album from the one preceding it. More atmospheric, more of one piece, with an overall more brooding approach, and mainly slow tempos.
Has a kind of darkness.
Yeah.
Also because of the three songs about Theo van Gogh, but also because of the whole sound.
Yeah.
A beautiful sound, I still think. It has to do with the drum sound.
Yeah.
On that album. And of course,
the drums were a special thing for me.
Yeah.
For La Nuit, because not long before we started doing La Nuit, I saw on the cover of Slagwerkrant, I saw this big Led Zeppelin orange drum set. So I went there and I saw it and I liked it very much. And then the idea came to me that I wanted to use this huge, really huge drum set, but play it very softly. Because I expected from this a certain kind of sound, and it worked. So I, especially when we did, I'm very happy the album starts with that song, because there you can really hear this sort of way of playing. Very soft playing on large drums.
Mm-hmm. I like the general atmosphere. It's
true.
Darker than the one before. Once again, we've done this.
Yeah.
We've done 1974. More playful, and this sounds more concentrated on the whole. Were you still working with demos then? Finished songs?
No, I don't think so. Well, maybe in some cases, of course, when we talked about song that's a little bit exceptional on this one, The Key Shop. You can find it back in demos and also the Eiffel Tower.
Well, I think there were more sort of parts of songs or ideas.
Yeah.
Every song we did more takes.
Yeah.
At this project, like playing, listening back, doing it again, and so on. That was more the approach.
Yeah.
But you were talking about like a first step of improvisation with one song on 1974.
Yeah, yeah, but this was not the direct...
A step further in that
No. It's sort of exceptional album. Sort of magic album for me.
It's a whole. W-H-O-L-A-E.
Yeah. Not the whole.
Not the whole.
No, not the song. That's why. It's very consistent.
Although there are really different... sounding songs on it.
Yeah, yeah.
Red Dog, for example.
And also The Milkman in the opposite way.
Yeah.
A smaller folkish approach.
Yeah.
But the main frame of the album is important. Could be the drum sound, but it could be the sounds of Robert Jan, the very, very light sounds. It's by guitar. It is playing a more important role, the acoustic guitar.
Yep.
Played not totally poppy, except for some moments.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, The Key Shop would be like the
Key Shop is from also almost another time. It was an older recording we picked up and went on again. It appears on demos already a long time ago. That's something else. But the other flow of the album is going on throughout it. And I think that's important, and I like the strings sometimes when they come
in. Sound good. Yeah. We played it yesterday.
Yeah.
It's beautiful.
Yeah. The sound of what
very nice arrange.
Yeah, but the sound they produce.
Yeah, it's good. But it's also because of the arrange.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
But a very good string quartet, the Baudrillard quartet. Yeah. Very great string quartet.
I always considered Lenui, if you want to put an image to it, like a flat landscape, the biggest part of it. It's sort of quiet, but there are always things going on there. It's with a long view.
Strangely enough, also a couple of tracks that lead you in a different direction, still a sense of unity that maybe me for myself, I lacked a little bit in 1974.
That is true.
The whole thing seems to hold together so well.
That's why I call it the whole. It's a whole.
Yeah. You said magic before, Robert.
Yeah, I think it's one way or another, the song La Nuit is sort of ruling over the whole album.
Absolutely. I totally agree.
Like
yeah.
It's sort of majestueux. Magic. It's magic.
There are not a lot of things going on in La Nuit because it moves so slowly.
No.
It's quite empty.
It's quite empty. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
What Robert Johnson says there, you can really feel the magic because for some reason it always keeps breathing.
NOS Journal.
Goedemiddag. Regisseur, schrijver en televisiemaker Theo van Gogh is vermoord. Hij werd vanmorgen rond 9 uur op de Linnaeusstraat in Amsterdam gedood.
On the morning of November 2nd, 2004, the publicist and film director Theo van Gogh was murdered by a 26-year-old Dutchman of Moroccan descent. This happened in the east of Amsterdam, right around the corner from Henk Hofstede's house.
It's safe to say that Van Gogh was always pushing the boundaries of also of good taste, right? I mean, the jokes he made, the way he expressed himself in his widely read columns, he was there to shock, he was there to upset. That was his idea of what culture and what freedom should be all about.
Geert Bulens is a Flemish poet and columnist, professor of modern Dutch literature at the University of Utrecht, and also a fan of De Nitz. His scientific focus is on themes like cultural history, modern Dutch literature, poetry, nationalism, and culture in times of crisis.
At first, it was a major shock, one of those 9/11 type earth-shattering moments. Yet the general, of course, it's always difficult to talk about a general opinion, but there's been, of course, ever since these horrific events of both 9/11 and the killing of Van Gogh, we've seen other types of fanaticism and mass killings in cultural context, of course, also concerts in England and Paris. And I think in general, people assess these horrific events as the horror that they are. But there's still also a discussion about should there be limits to freedom of speech? What about the burning of the Quran? Should that be seen as a type of freedom of speech? And on that, I think the jury is still out. But as far as I can assess, I think that that many people will say, well, freedom of speech is very important, but it doesn't give you a license to say and do everything.
The events of 24 years ago are especially disturbing since the murder took place in Amsterdam, which projects a completely different image of the city.
Many people in Amsterdam see themselves and see their city as sort of a free state where everything is possible. Also, let's say on a moral level, of course, it was a city that in a very short period of time in the 60s changed to this international icon of free sex, free drugs, free everything. It wasn't the image of Amsterdam in the early 60s at all. But by the end of the 60s and the early 70s, you'd have American Rolling Stone newspaper reporters coming to Amsterdam and describing the way the city's underground functioned. And they were just stunned that you could hear on the radio the daily prices of soft drugs. It was just broadcast on the radio. And you'd have pornography in regular cinemas. So in a very short period of time, Amsterdam became this free state of liberated people.
Over the last few years, the square has somehow or other become the rendezvous and roosting place of the international hippies. It became famous as a sort of United Nations of the young. Nobody knows exactly why.
I would like to stay, like here in Amsterdam. It's a beautiful city, and the young people and the old people get along so beautifully, so much more beautifully than in the States.
Now, Debbie, you've been in Holland for a full day now.
Yes.
And this is the famous Vondelpark. What do you think about it?
I think it's really nice. There's a lot of young people here and a lot of nice grass. It's amazing. This is right in the city, isn't it?
This is right in the middle of the city, yes. Is this, you think, especially the atmosphere of Amsterdam?
It expresses to me much warmth and friendliness. It really does. I think it's great.
The NIDS, they were formed in 74, but their crucial years of socialization, culturally, politically, are the 60s. And indeed, in the 60s, as I said before, Amsterdam became this symbol of this type of culture. And parts of Amsterdam are still like that. Most of Amsterdam is just, it's a commercial playground, right? It's like so many European cities. But there is still pockets of that 60s spirit around and also in culture. And I think the NIDS are a great example. They have built a very steady career exploring the many different aspects of their own culture and history. And that is a cultural treasure beyond any doubt, as far as I'm concerned. But it is a bubble. That is not necessarily or quintessentially Dutch. Maybe we would like it to be like that, but it's just not the case. There are so many other aspects to Dutch cultural life and Dutch history. I think the band members indeed express what many people, specifically of their generation, felt like. So these are people who consider themselves and their country to be the quintessentially liberal type of people, but also a very, very liberal society. But it's really not the case that everybody in Holland has this liberal view on life or society. That it's just not true. And I think that it's something you can believe in if you live in specific cities where that indeed feels like a generally shared idea. And I share that idea myself, right? And most of my friends and colleagues do. When the album came out, Henk Hofstede gave an interview to a Belgian newspaper, and one phrase struck me, where he talked about how Amsterdam had lost its innocence because of the killing of Van Gogh. Now, if you know that the initial wealth of Amsterdam was built on slave trade, it's very, very strange to talk about sort of innocence of Amsterdam. I mean, there is an historical guilt at the center of the city center. All these great canals and mansions are part of a great but also very, very cruel history. And that is a discussion that has been prominent in Dutch society over the last 10 years, you could say, also as a result of the Black Lives Matter movement and of Dutch homegrown activists who have been addressing the colonial past. And that has changed to a certain extent the way Dutch society looks at itself. And when I talk about the generation of the NIDS or even my generation, if I compare that to my students' outlook on life, I don't think my students would ever use a term like innocence when they're talking about Amsterdam or Dutch history or Dutch society. It's just no longer a valid approach to their home country.
The murder of Theo van Gogh was a major event, but did it have a lasting impact?
The polarization in society was at first, I think, enhanced by the murder. But today, I think it is just one of the many, many culture wars we are fighting. Every week there is a new culture war. And Van Gogh's culture war was 20 years ago. So that is a long, long time ago. I mean, I think 9/11 and Van Gogh sort of set the stage for many of these culture wars. So on that level, they still have an importance. But there are so many other incidents and so many other discussions in society that have taken over or that have gained in prominence.
I had a terrible dream. The hour was early. I walk in my neighborhood. I turn a corner. I see a river of blood with angels drowning. Devils with black parachutes fall down with bare feet on the street with sound of a thunder incredibly loud. My hands are on my ears.
I didn't see the killing, but I heard the shots. When I woke up, I thought, ooh, what's going to happen? And then later I found out what happened, and I went to see the place, and there was this white tent over him. And anyway, that followed me, that atmosphere.
At the time, you said, this will change Holland, yeah. in outlook. Did something change, and what changed, or what do you think was threatened by it?
Well, it not to be the only murder. So that's what happened. Like the Fortuyn, the politician, also.
Yeah, Pim Fortuyn, the right wing politician.
Yeah. Also, not everybody was agreeing with his way of thinking, and it was a terrible thing to murder him.
Absolutely.
And it was the same thing with Theo van Gogh. Once Holland was a country that you did not expect those things to happen, but
that's
with the second time, you knew things had changed.
Yeah.
We're not so tolerant as we thought. That was always the image throughout Europe, maybe even throughout the world,
that
we were so tolerant in Holland. And all of a sudden, this dream was totally smashed. And then we were confronted with, I think, our lack of really interest in what's going on in society. Because we always thought, well, that doesn't happen in Holland. Well, there you go. And then all of a sudden, everybody woke up. And then this, of course, from the one side, people started realizing much more how big the differences were in opinion, and try to make the connection again. And on the other hand, on the other extreme, there were more and more people thinking, well, why not do it also? So, you know, so it got much more aggressive on that side. Mm-hmm. And that was a big change in Holland. I mean, also nowadays, as we speak, it happens all the time.
We didn't knew then how our society was already changed.
Yeah, exactly.
We were surprised by it.
And
how, in this case, how religion came back in our society. Because we, through the 60s, let's say, we said goodbye to religion, more or less. And then it came back in a totally different way in our society. And there you go.
The fact is that also in the earlier days, let's say the 50s and 60s, religion played a very bad role in society. People putting away, children taken away from their parents and so on. But the churches didn't talk about it. And this particular event, this murder, put a light on all the Islamic people, but also we suddenly realized that our hands weren't very clean either in our own history.
And it happens in Amsterdam, which seems to be one of the liberal cities.
That's true.
That's true.
Main cities in the world.
We thought.
Tolerance and et cetera. Yeah. Maybe the end of some sort of 60-ish dream, you know,
like we felt, or I felt, when John Lennon was killed, that something stopped.
Strangely enough, it was
it's impossible that this hero is killed. Mm. That cannot happen.
And it's so stupid that it's caused by one person. It's so crazy that they have the chance to change the world.
By
being crazy.
That's true.
This is one of the very first times, and I think that shows a bit the importance, that you wrote a song that was so closely connected to something social, political, if you like. We had Vaholanda Seni Seni way back when.
Yeah.
And here's another one. It's even a trilogy.
So it takes some room, you know, like
it takes some room.
Yeah.
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 It must have been like a gigantic shock that I can only imagine.
Yeah, but strangely enough, you don't think about it that much. You just do it, and it happened like this. And we were recording, we were making these songs, and most of the time there were songs without words. But this happened, and it just walked in. It came in.
Yeah.
And I was trying to write about it a bit popish way to compare it with Penny Lane. I'm talking about all the shops.
Yeah, yeah.
And what happened with all the people standing in the shops when he was killed.
Yeah, it's this contrast of like everyday life.
Everyday life, but it was. Mm-hmm. I mean, my daughters went to school. They were always going through the park. She was stopped by the police because the killer was running through the park here.
Yeah.
So in everyday life, the normal things you do around 9 o'clock, going to school and going to work, were rudely
destroyed.
Hier zijn de Nits met Henk Hofstede, gitaar en zang. Robert-Jan Stips, toetsen en zang. Rob Kloet, drums. En Marjolein van der Klauw, zang en gitaar. En ze beginnen met The Key Shop.
This is Marjolein van der Klauw. I'm working as a psychologist, a therapist for grown-ups. And I sing and play the guitar. And yeah, the most favorite thing for me to do is to sing with others. Actually, to do the backing vocals is the thing that makes me happy. Strangely enough, while I knew, and Henk told this, of course, also on stage he told this, while I knew what it was about, he did, I think, in a way transform it into something much bigger. Like he lifted it up. So while singing it, or even while listening to it, I didn't, and I don't mean this disrespectfully to the event, but I don't even think about that event so much. Because it's about something much bigger. It's war and peace. War and peace. To me, it seems like organic. With which I mean that I have the feeling, and I don't know, of course, how it really is, but I have the feeling that they're so, especially with the three of them, are so true to themselves. There must be a lot of trust also in each other and in what they can do with each other, and yeah, really true to something. Of course, for years and years, I worked with Henk in the Avalanche Quartet, fortunately. But yeah, with those men, it was, I remember recording in the Werf, the studio. Well, there's nothing surprising, I think, when I say this, but they're so, like, kind and playful and open to ideas. And yeah, it's just... It was really a joy, yeah.
It was a sound like if you change just one slightly thing on a knob, it disappeared. It was just a coincidence of a setting that was producing that sound. And if it was just slightly off, it was not there. And so it was very hard to find back. And also because Paul put a special effect on it. So yeah, it was combination of two things.
Yeah. That's
one of the nice things of Kurzweil, that sometimes certain sounds come out.
I always liked very much this distorted quality in the context of the whole song.
It's
a sort of almost romantic singing, almost. You know?
Well, it's one of the few times that I'm singing falsette.
Yeah, we did more on the.
We did more.
Because
I don't know what happened, but somehow I thought that falsette singing would fit this color of instruments.
Yep, yep.
And in this case, it's even a combination with the female voice. It's Marjolein singing the other part. So it's strange that I am the highest one and she's lower. There's something that it works very well with the sounds coming from the instruments. They were a little bit imitating the instruments with my
I
love and I.
Yeah.
It's like you imitate
alien.
Imitate violence.
Wong Song is a good example, I think. That's a song about waiting, if you talk about the way we instrumentated it. Because we always made dun, 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 dun.
And there were no measures.
There were no measures, no.
It was a line, and then there was silence. And I asked Rob to do something in the silence. And that was the whole appointment.
Yes, but at the same time, it's kind of difficult, isn't it?
No, not,
well,
not
for me. It's a matter of daring.
Yeah.
To keep silent longer than you normally would, and then the whole idea of the song became the long song. And because of the atmosphere, I wrote this lyrics that I still don't know what it is exactly about. Yeah, it's a package of mystery and mystery and silence.
Yeah.
We made time flexible in a way, It's like a piece of flexible string. How long can you
until it breaks. That's
what we tried probably.
It illustrates how we can handle time. I think we are quite exceptional band. We are one of the few bands that are able to play from the start without 1, 2, 3,
No.
If it's possible, we avoid it.
No counting. No.
We can do it on a breath or movement. Yeah. Or I think it's very important. It tells you something about the whole song when you start like this. This sigh.
Breath, So far, I haven't seen a band just starting from nothing.
No, most of the bands, and even when it's totally unnecessary, when the song starts, let's say with an harmonica solo, still the drummer, tak, tak, tak,
or even worse, first he says to himself, 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4.
And then you wrong it, then you know it's very wrong. Counting, come on.
No, I always hated that.
Yeah, but I think it wouldn't also, you could also say it wouldn't work for us.
No.
To make this sort of almost rigid start to a song. It destroys the intro to start with. I think. It's
silence is golden. Important. As many musicians say, like silence between notes is as important as the notes themselves.
So it's all in there. I mean, this waiting, this space.
Ting,
it
ting.
Is this. It's a good album to use as an example.
Yeah. I think that's one of the things I talked a lot in the earlier days to a good friend of ours from Belgium. She is a philosopher. On mail, we started a discussion about drumming, about music, about lyrics. And then she asked me what thoughts I had about my own drumming. And then all of a sudden I realized, and that's exactly what Hank and Robert John also said. In other words, I just divide the time in bits. And the nice thing is when you have hit the drum or whatever instrument, then there is an energy going on. And you just wait until the energy stops. And then only then the next beat is really necessary. So in fact the drummer's job is to divide the time in bits with a story in between, to put it very philosophical. And of course the grooves and all those beautiful things can happen anyway, but that's in fact the basic thing for me always, preferably doing nothing.
It says here there's a time to laugh, a time to speak, a time to keep silence.
Well,
that's just about where Lenny starts.
It's true. Yeah.
Thank you.